Okay, let's turn to Exodus 7 to begin. So we're going to start to look at the plagues. We might be able to make it through all of them tonight. But let's start in Exodus 7, read verses 14 through 25. Now this is the first plague where the water of the Nile is turned into blood. That's verse 14 through 25. Now there's always, whenever you come to certain things in the Bible, there's always difference of opinion, even with many of the theologians that study and look at this. God would have no problem, we're dealing with the miracle here, he would have no problem changing the river to actual blood. But I want to show you how there's two verses that I found that say something very similar, but you'll see that it's not actually blood. This is in Joel. I'll read these. Joel 2:31, and the sun shall be turned into darkness. This is talking about the day of the Lord, I believe. Yes, in verse 28, he talks about, I'll pour out my spirit upon all flesh. Sons and daughters shall prophesy. We know that verse. Then a few verses later, he says, the sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood. Now, we know that the moon is not going to literally be turned into blood from someone's body, right? We understand that. So he's talking about a color. The moon will be turned to blood. That's how the Bible states it. But it doesn't literally mean blood. It means it's going to be turned into a color, a red, that's similar to blood. So that's why it's just said that way. And then he goes on. And then in 2 Kings 3, verse 22, then they rose up early in the morning, and the sun was shining on the water, and the Moabites saw the water on the other side as red as blood. So it doesn't necessarily mean it was blood. They saw it, maybe the reflection, and it looked red as blood. So again, coming back to where we are here in chapter 7 of Exodus, it very well could have been literal blood. But it's probably a little more reasonable to think that it was changed into a color similar to blood. Remember that the Nile, every season, would overflow its banks. And actually, I'll bring this out in a few minutes. And that was a sign to the Egyptians that the god of the Nile, their god, was at work. And at that time, whenever the floodwaters would come, it would pick up a lot of debris, a lot of silt, and it would turn the waters into a different color. That would be different than what the Lord did, because when the Lord did it, something actually happened in the water to where the fish died. Whereas the normal, natural thing, like some theologians will say, well, you know, the Lord performed these miracles through Moses at a certain time of the year because that was a natural phenomenon of that year, of that time of the year. But whenever that happened in the natural, the fish didn't die. It was just whenever this was pronounced that something different occurred. So it could be if somebody says, well, it was actually blood. Well, okay, I can believe that. But it may not have been. Just wanted to just say that. It may have just been where it was changed in a way that resembled blood, like the other two scriptures that I read. And another thing is that this occurred only when Aaron used the rod and touched the water. So this was not a natural phenomena. I've heard even about the parting of the Red Sea, that, you know, so, you know, something happened upstream, and, you know, the waters became like a dam, and all, you know, people think all these crazy things. And they look at you and say, no, what you're saying is crazy. But I would rather believe the Word of God than what someone would try to do as far as scientifically discount or try to figure out what happened scientifically. I have no problem believing in a miracle. And as I said, this very well may have been that as far as actual blood, who knows. But it was only for a short period of time, and it was changed back. And the interesting thing, that when you were reading this, that it says that not only did the waters in the Nile turn to blood, but also any small puddles or any other spots where there was water, any vessels that they had. Remember, you know, they didn't have city water like we have, or some of us have. They would go down, and that still takes place in a lot of countries of the world. You go to Africa, you go to South America, all the countries I've visited in South America, Central America, they all, the majority of them, go and get their water. Some places they have some city water that's turned on for 2 hours a day only. So in different countries, different things, but a lot of times they would haul the water, and that, or they would fill up big barrels of water for washing laundry, for drinking, you know, all that from the barrels, from the, you know, going back and forth to a water source. But even those, of course, back then they didn't have any type of piping or anything, but back, you know, they would go to the river and take their water and fill vessels and keep it in their homes for drinking and washing or whatever. But even those vessels, the water that was in those vessels was actually changed in some way. So it wasn't just the Nile River, which is even makes it even, I mean, a miracle is a miracle. It doesn't matter if it's just one thing or something. But that, even that's even, as far as I'm concerned, is even a greater thing than just touching the water here and then just that water turns. But not only that, but everywhere that they had water turned to blood. When the Lord does this attack on the Nile, he is dealing with the gods of the Nile, the gods of Egypt, because they believed the power of life of all the Egyptians came from the river, from the Nile. One of the gods was called Sotis. He was the god, or he was probably she, he or she was the god of the Nile floodwaters. And another god was Kethnum, the giver of the Nile, creator. They believed that god was the creator of mankind. And have you ever seen Egyptian architecture or their statues and what have you of a human person with a ram's head? Well, that is this particular god, the god of the Nile. I guess it's Khnum, Khnum. They believed that he was the one, or she, I guess he, was the giver of life, the creator of mankind. So the gods of Egypt, the Lord is doing certain things to strike out against that. And you'll see as it progresses down the line here to the 10th plague of the firstborn, that's another strike at the gods of Egypt. Now, you know, it wasn't just that, you know, Moses went in, Aaron went in, and did this random thing that God's telling them to do. No, God is very calculating. God does things for a reason. Whether we see it, understand it, know it, believe it, he has a purpose behind what he does. And we should bear that in mind, because we will find out that in our life there will be things that happen that we will not quite understand. Or they may happen, we may see them, and we may think we understand, and God may have some other purpose going on there, and we're dealing with the thing here that we see, and he has something else that he's doing through this. So his ways are not our ways. But sometimes it's very difficult for us to believe the Lord can do something in a situation that may not look good or appealing. We may think it's totally, forget it, it's not good. But we don't know sometimes. We just don't know. And God can do things far, far above what we see and know and understand. And I believe that most people, when they read this, would not see that the Lord is striking out against the gods of Egypt in the things he does. But it's true. Okay, Exodus 8, 1 through 15. Now, this is the second plague. And this is the plague of the frogs. Now remember in chapter 7 here that the magicians of Egypt, verse 22, then the magicians of Egypt did so with their enchantments. Or I looked these words up. It gives this impression that either they performed a miracle, either the enemy, demonic spirits, are empowering these magicians to physically do a miracle or a sign like we see in Revelation. Or They are like the illusionists, and they're performing magic that gives the appearance that it's just like what Moses and Aaron is doing. It could be either one. But the word here is dealing with magician. When I would go into certain word study books, that was one of the things that kept on coming up, cropping up when I was looking at this in my study. And if you look at today's magicians, they do things that are kind of really, they call it sleight of hand. Some of it's like so far out there. I don't know if you've ever seen some of the people that do things now. Have you ever watched anything? Some of the, like even some of the card tricks that they do, it's just like really crazy stuff. So they deal with illusion. And so here in this verse, it said they did so with their enchantments. Anybody have another translation? What's the NIV say for verse 22? With their magic, maybe?
In chapter 8, verse
7, 22.
But the Egyptian magicians did the same things by their secret arts.
Secret arts what?
Secret arts.
Yeah. So it's not saying specifically that they were performing a miracle. It may be something different. We don't know. The first plague of the water turning to blood, and the second plague that we're going to look at now of the frogs, the magicians somehow were able to do something similar to what Moses and Aaron did. In verse 7 it says, and the magician did also or so with their enchantments and brought up frogs on the land of Egypt. But one of the things we see is they could not do anything to make them go, or else they would have. This plague must have been very aggravating to the Egyptians because, believe it or not, the frog was a sacred animal to them. In a certain time of the year, in September, they would have the summer flooding, and the Egyptians actually liked to hear the frogs because that meant that one of their goddesses, called Het, did her job of providing enough water for them for the rest of the year. The water would flood, the frogs would come. But they've never seen anything like this, where now all the frogs filled the land into their houses, into their kneading troughs, jumping into their beds. I don't think that a lot of people got any sleep with not just a frog, but frogs jumping all over them and all around them and so on. And so again, you can see the Lord strikes at the religious system of Egypt in this goddess called Hekt. Another thing here was this goddess called Hekt, they also believed that she helped the women in childbirth. So now if you translate that over to the 10th plague, where the firstborn is killed, once again, God is striking at that system. You see? Again. Okay, in chapter 8, verses 8, I'll read these. Verses 16 through 19 is the third plague, and that's the plague of lice. Let me say this, because I looked at this. It depends on your translation. The King James uses the word lice. The New King James uses the word gnat. The NIV uses the word maggots. The RSV uses the word fleas. So the Hebrew word is not definitive. They may not have known when they translated the Bible. They may not have known the root of the word. They can't ascertain the root of it. You know, what this word came from, what root in the Hebrew. And so they're not sure. So you'll get some of these words, and it won't be definitive. The thing that is definitive is it was an insect for sure, and it was very, very bothersome. And from what I read, it seems as though it very well may have been lice. I mean, it could have been yours says maggot, right? Oh, it says gnats? Okay. It could have been a gnat. Let me read this. Verse 16. So the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your rod and strike the dust of the land so that it may become lice throughout all the land of Egypt. And they did so, for Aaron stretched out his hand with his rod and struck the dust of the earth, and it became lice on man and beast. Now, just that, if that's a correct translation of the Hebrew, when it says where it became lice on man and beast, it very well may be lice, because gnats don't stay on the body, as far as I know. I mean, they get in your eyes, you know, gnats are. They get up your nose, they get in your ears. But they like the moisture. They go towards your eyes. It would be very annoying. But that actually being on your body could be fleas. Fleas can, you know, get on your body and your hair like an animal. But lice, you know, lice can be on your body too. But regardless of what it is, it's a judgment from God to try to get Pharaoh. And by the way, Pharaoh, even though he had servants and even though he had people that he could order to do whatever, he could have had them clean and clean and clean and clean his whole court, but that's not going to stop the lice from attaching themselves to him also. So he had to go through the same thing. That's what's so, not puzzling, but you would think. See, we look at it from how our hearts are, and we say, why didn't he just get the idea, and why didn't he leave the people go? Why didn't he just submit to the Lord? But see, we look at it from our heart condition, which is softer, which is surrendered to the Lord, and we see things much differently. He had control. He wanted control. He didn't want the Hebrews to exercise anything that they wanted, exercise their will. And he's sure not going to listen to Moses and Aaron, especially Moses, who grew up in Egypt. He wants to show him a thing or two that, you know, we did these things for you, and now look at you, and we're not going to listen to anything you say. I mean, it could have been a lot of different things going on with him. For sure, his heart was hardened toward the Lord and toward Moses and Aaron. And even though he has to deal also, not just the people, but he has to also deal himself with these plagues, he still pushes through and hardens his heart. Verse 17, and it became lice on men and beast. All the dust of the land became lice throughout all the land of Egypt. See, so wherever there's dust, and you know, that's everywhere. They didn't have concrete roads. They didn't have asphalt roads. And they may have had some brick roads, but mainly it's dust. And all the dust there beneath them, around them, turned to lice. And then, you know, you can't go anywhere. You can't do anything without them getting on you. So it's pretty intense thing. Verse 18. Now the magicians so worked with their enchantments to bring forth lice, but they could not. See, so they tried, but they couldn't do it. There were lice on men and beast. Now, because the magicians could not duplicate at all, remember they duplicated to some degree the turning the water into blood. And then to some degree they were able to call up frogs from the river. I don't understand it. I don't know it. I don't know anything about that. But to some degree, they were able to do something similar in some way, to some small degree. But now, when it comes to the lice, this is totally different. So the Lord allows them to exercise their enchantments or their magic or whatever for a period of time. Okay, you know, you can do this. That's fine. It reminds me of 1 Kings, I believe it's chapter 18, where Elijah tells them, he says, okay, let's stack up all this wood, and you can call upon your gods to bring down fire and consume the wood. And so remember, they chanted and prayed and jumped around and cut themselves with sharp objects to try to get their gods to bring fire down and consume the wood. And they did that, you know, half the day, or however long it was. And then Elijah steps up and he says, okay, dig a moat around the water and carry around the wood and carry water up and drench the wood with water. And if you ever tried burning wood that's wet, it doesn't burn too well at all. Even if there's a little bit of moisture inside the wood, not just if the wood's wet, if moisture inside the wood, it doesn't burn well at all. So he tells him, soak the wood until the water runs off and fills this trench around there. Then he prays, and he prays to the Lord and calls down fire from heaven, and the fire consumes the wood, and the Bible says, and it licked up, or it caused the heat, caused all the water in the trench to evaporate, disappear. And so even though the Lord allowed them with their prayer and their enchantments and their cutting of themselves a portion of time, now the Lord steps in and he shows them what the true power of God is like. And so with this here, he lets them go with the water turning to blood. He lets them go when it comes to the frogs. But now things are progressing. They can only go so far. Man's efforts, even his joint efforts, will only take him so far. And then there's a point at which man's efforts can no longer carry him, can no longer enter into the circumstance in the picture, so to speak, to do what he wants. Just like, you know, man will, for example, like athletic competition, you know, he'll break a record, he'll break this world record, and you know, this far and this far, and then eventually, it will peak. And then unless something else happens with the individual, like he pumps himself up with steroids or something, he can't exceed this particular point, whatever that point is. That there's no more progression upward past that. It's just done. With this, the Lord is moving on. And even though he has allowed the magicians to do certain things up to this point, now the magicians even know. Now Pharaoh, who knows what's going on in his mind? He may have known, but he's going to harden his heart no matter what. The magicians are going to know, and eventually you're going to see the servants of Pharaoh. They even come to him, the ones that were on his side and hardened their hearts just like he did. Eventually, they said, Egypt is in ruins. You have to let them go. And he doesn't let them go yet. So in verse 19, then the magician said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. So they recognized that there is no longer anything that they could possibly do to imitate what has taken place. So the Lord keeps on moving on here. And from this point on, everything the Lord does, the magicians, they can't do anything similar. They can't do anything about it. They're out of the picture, basically. And then it goes on here, it says, but Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them, just as the Lord had said. So they're telling him, this is the finger of God. This is God at work. Not the God of Egypt, or the gods of Egypt. But this is the God of the Hebrews at work, and we've never seen anything like this, and we can't do anything about it. Now, with the gnats or with the lice, what takes place is a complete failure on the part of the magicians. They can't do a thing about it. At this point, God restrains them. You know, they can't function at all. Verse 19, we looked at that. And the magicians, it's interesting that even when Aaron and Moses were doing these things, you know, with the rod, they were able to do that, and with the other two, they were not hindered by Moses and Aaron. They were not bound by Moses and Aaron, but now they're bound by God. There's nothing more they can do, and they don't even go out and try. Okay, verse 20, this is another one. This is 8:20 through 32. And it's interesting that the Lord knows when Pharaoh's getting up. The Lord knows when he's going to come out to the river for water. Now, you would think that with all that's going on, he could send his servants, which he could, to go. But he probably wanted to get up and get out and, you know, go down to the river. And who does he see? Who does the Lord bring right there to confront him? So the Lord is always ahead of the curve, so to speak. You know, we in our own self-efforts are always behind the curve, not the Lord. He gets out there and he knows. And so he communicates to Moses, you know, go over there and wait. I have taught you what to say, and you say this when Pharaoh comes down. When I read that, I thought, this is very interesting, that he knows he's going to be coming down there, and there he is, Moses, already, you know, the man of God, being in the place of God, and the Lord is able to use him in that way, knowing that Pharaoh's going to come. Right. Now, the thing is, you see this throughout this portion of Scripture here, that they go in and they say, thus saith the Lord. That there cannot be duplicated, if you know what I'm saying. Because someone comes and says, thus saith the Lord, does not mean it's a thus saith the Lord. You understand what I'm saying? Because in my experience, Christians always think they're right. They think they're right about this. They think they're right about what's going on with them. They think they're right about your life. They think they're right about your children's life. They think about right about everybody's life. Not everybody, I'm just saying, in general, we think, all of us, we have a brain, and there's a electrical chemical compound that moves in our thinking that causes electrical current. The chemicals cause electric current, and that electric current will bring thoughts. You know, you will have a thought, and the process, I don't understand it, but the thought process of different people is different, you know that. I mean, you can see that in government. So everybody thinks differently. And that's not untrue, you know, throughout the whole gamut of life. Now, to think differently is not necessarily wrong, because, you know, a lot of the people who are different thinkers were the ones that had the greatest inventions of mankind, like electric, because they looked at things differently than other people. So that's not wrong. But our thinking, because I form a thought, does not mean that my thought is totally correct when it comes to you. You understand what I'm saying? So I form a thought, and now I'm saying, okay, and I'm telling you this is this. It may not be true. So I have heard this years and years ago in the church, probably before anybody here was in the church. You know, you have somebody that comes around and they'll come over, you know, and they'll pray for you and say, thus saith the Lord, now they're going to prophesy something over you. Well, okay, that's fine. I'm okay with that. But I want to know if what they're saying is from God. Because everybody thinks what they're saying is from God. And so the individual says, such as I said, well, okay. And I'll hold that and say, okay, Lord, is this from you or is this not from you? But the problem is, sometimes, I remember this one individual was in the church and he would say certain things, and they were right on. They were right on. He would say things that, you know, about this particular thing, and it was right on. But yet, even with him, there was his blind area. He didn't see certain things related to his own life. And then you have other people that would do this, and they wouldn't even have to say the thus said. Years ago, that's what they used to do. How long have you been a Christian?
7 years.
How long have you been a Christian? Have you ever heard anybody say, thus saith the Lord? It was very common in the 70s. You know, my age now here. It was a very common thing. You know, people would, you know, do the thus saith the Lord and it'd be this loud thing. And so the point is this, that you have to ascertain and go to the Lord to see if what is being said, is it from the Lord or is it from the person? Is I could have a real strong thing, for example, about you, and something that I think. And I could say that to you, which I don't normally do that. I do not walk around saying things to people. I don't. Unless I know for sure it's the Lord. Then I may say something, but now it's up to them. I let it at that. Done. Okay. Now you do what you want. But it can be a thing where someone's opinion is put out. And I remember, I won't get into this, years ago, some things happened in the church, and this one individual had this word for another person. It's funny. The funny thing is, I noticed something about that, is that rarely does rarely do they have a word like that for themselves. It's always for somebody else. I wonder why that is. Thus saith the Lord for you, but not, it doesn't go this way. My finger goes that way. Why is that? Because I can see some, maybe something in that person's life, but I can't see anything in my own. Can't see what's going on with me. Anyway, well, I don't even know where, well, how we got there. Oh, thank you. Boy, I'm glad you came. You came at the right time, brother. So you see that here, and you see that from Moses, and you see that that is a pronouncement from the Lord, because you see the Lord in the picture the whole time with Moses, dealing with Moses, doing things with Moses, speaking to Moses, teaching Moses, all this. And Moses didn't want to go, but the Lord sent him anyway. And so he's hearing what the Lord is saying, and he's giving it to Pharaoh. Now, if you want to be Pharaoh, maybe there'll be a thus saith the Lord for you. And like I said, I'm glad that that's not in the church like it was years ago, not just in the group that I was in, but I mean, it was other groups were in other churches, same thing. So that can be a dangerous thing. Now, of course, there's a time for it. If it's the Lord, that's a different story. But it can be a dangerous thing, especially if someone is trying to impose their thinking on another. You understand what I'm saying? So you weren't ever exposed to that. Maybe you don't know, but I'm just trying to explain it to you. You know, so if something comes your way, then now it's up to you to hear, is that from the Lord or is that not? Now, you remember now, some 15 years ago or so, when there was something going on in the church that was there. And we found out later, not that that was so wrong, it's just the person was deceiving the people. And the Lord showed me that in a dream. I only had a couple dreams like that in my life. And that was one of the things the Lord showed me in a dream. And he showed me it. And then the person was in front of me in this dream. And I looked up and I said, you're deceiving. You're deceived, trying to deceive me. And he just got this big grin on my face. And I woke up and said, what's that about? And the Lord showed me what it was. There was a deception in the church. And that thing as far as, and I don't want to say the prophecy. Of course, prophecy is not wrong. The Bible talks about it's a gift of the Spirit. As long as it's used by the Spirit, that's the point. And we have to divorce ourselves in our thinking and our views from that if we're to be used by the Lord in that. That has to be somehow separated. Just like the preacher, there are preachers, and you don't know that because, well, there are preachers who will see something wrong in the church and will prepare a sermon to speak right to that thing. Instead of allowing the Lord to handle it. It's better to allow the Lord to handle the situation, no matter what it is, that's the way I see it. Because he is well able to show a person if they're going in the wrong way or to teach them or to bring them along, whatever. He is well able to do that. He doesn't need me to see something with you and go ahead and preach on that. You understand what I'm saying? I don't do that. Now, the Lord has these ways of you teaching, being totally innocent of what's going on with other people. I like it when I don't know what's going on with people. Like when I'm teaching up this other Bible school, I only know one person out of all the people there, I know one person. So I know nothing about their lives. I'll know what's going on. And that's actually pretty good because now I can speak. And now they're not going to think I'm talking about them because they know that I don't know them. You understand what I'm saying? And I had somebody in the church come up to me. This one individual come up to me at least four times. It's probably a lot more than four times. And I did not know certain things were going on in his life. And he told me, this is exactly what's going on. And what you said was exactly pertaining to this. Well, I mean, I didn't go home and prepare some message toward that. I'm glad I didn't even know about it. So pronouncing, thus saith the Lord, is a dangerous thing. And if a person is going to say something about you in your personal life, they better make sure it's the Lord. So you are responsible to determine whether that is a pronouncement from the Lord to you or from the spirit of the individual that's coming out toward you because I see something, you see? And that's not the way it's to be. It's supposed to be. If we're going to function in something like that, and I think that prophecy sometimes is not used in the church because of that reason. Now, I've been in church when you have, you know, message in tongues, interpretation in tongues equals prophecy, right? And I've been in church, and I've been used in message of tongues years ago, and occasionally interpretation of tongues. But that is a little different, because that is usually related to the collective body. But now when you come to a prophecy related to an individual, that's something different. It's not used in the setting of the gifts of the Spirit that we see in Corinthians, because that's dealing with the church in general. So the use of prophecy, now I've been used in prophecy occasionally at the front when I pray for someone and the Lord gives me a few sentences or whatever related to them. And I'm most of the time I don't even know what's going on, but I'll just give what I feel. But I don't go around. Now, we're not at church. I'm not praying for you. Now I'm going to prophesy that this for you. Now, I'm not doing that unless the Lord really impresses upon me to do that. Now, that's me. So if you see something in the church or in someone in the church, that does not necessarily mean that you're to go and correct that. You know that. Because you can see things, because you can understand things. Maybe from your study, the Lord's opening your eyes to certain things. And you can see a person, you can see something in that person's life that it can be a potentially dangerous thing. So now because you see it, you're going to go run over and tell them about it and try to correct it. No, you can hold on to that. And the Lord may or may not ever have you do that. He may do that just so you start to be able to see things. And he may just take care of things on his own, which a lot of times he does. And so that whole thing I've seen 40 years ago. I saw that before you were born, both of you guys, and you saw those things in the. Oh no, I know better. Okay, you too. I'll make you feel young. But I saw that 42 years ago, and you know I was young. I didn't understand, but I was able to say, "Lord, okay, now you teach me. You show me what's going on." And he was able to teach me. You know how he taught me some of these things? By seeing the contrast. In my spirit, understanding the contrast. This is coming out, and there's no disturbance in the flow of the Spirit. Not whatsoever. It's just the Spirit of God just keeps on. Now this comes out from this individual, and the Spirit of God kind of just, it's like taking a needle and hitting a balloon. Go, all the air comes out. It's just like the Spirit of God just starts to just less and less and less, and then it's gone. So I was able to see the contrast. And I, looking back on it, that was a very good learning tool, even though this individual would do things out of order and incorrectly in the church, and even with individuals in the church saying certain things, looking at them and telling them certain things that were from her and not from the Lord. And I was able to see that thing, and I was experiencing that, and I was able to tell the difference. But you don't need that to be able to tell the difference. You just need to depend upon the Lord. So what I'm saying is that something like that can occur, but it does not necessarily mean it's of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord is not necessarily from the Lord. So in this instance with Moses, we know that he is being used by God and the whole thing's laid out here. All the communication dealing with Pharaoh. And when he goes and he says, thus saith the Lord, he is saying something that is coming from God himself. And that may not always be the case with Christians, and many times is not the case with Christians. So when I hear certain things, and believe me, I've heard a lot of different things over the years from different people. So not everything that comes down the pike, not everything that comes from Christians is not a biased thing. Sometimes it's a biased thing. So you have to be able to discern and look to the Lord and say, okay, Lord, now what do you want me to do? Because if you want me to do or not do or whatever it may be, that's fine. As long as we have a heart like that, then the Lord's able to show us. But because it comes from a Christian, doesn't necessarily mean it's from God. It may be coming from the person's spirit. And that's the best I can tell you. Be aware of that. That's another interesting point that Moses knew, because he grew up in Egypt. He knew that what the Lord was asking them to do in the sacrifices would be an abominable thing with the Egyptians. You know, even today, there are so many animal lovers. And animal lovers, that's okay, as long as you love your neighbor more than your animal. You know, there's people who love their animals more than their relatives or their neighbors or anybody else. Depends on your perspective of that. But anyway, even today, people would never understand. If that was going on today, there would be protests upon protests upon protests across the world. So whenever they start to sacrifice again in the temple, if that is covered, it very well may not be. If that is covered internationally, I think there would be protests everywhere. Here they are. They're actually breeding these red heifers, which they thought were extinct, but they weren't. They found them, and I've heard that they've been taking them and breeding them. And I guess when there's enough of them, if they were to, there would have to be other things that would have to happen. The Dome of the Rock would either have to be destroyed somehow before the temple could be built, or the temple would have to be built in another site. Irregardless, if they were to start to sacrifice the red heifer and these other animals on a daily basis, or even once a year, like the annual Day of Atonement, just think what people would think about that in this country that, you know, are the animal lovers. And that would just be way too much for them. But I just wanted to point that out, that Moses knew that this would be super offensive to the Egyptians. That's why, probably one of the reasons why the Lord wanted them out of Egypt to sacrifice out there, not there in Egypt. And for other reasons also. Okay, go ahead.
And Pharaoh said, I will let you go that you may sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness, and he shall not go very far away. Entreat for me. Moses said, behold, I go out from thee, and I will entreat the Lord that the swarms of flies may depart from Pharaoh, from his servants, from his people tomorrow. But let not Pharaoh deal deceitfully any more in not letting the people go to sacrifice.
Well, that didn't happen. He's deceitful as far along as he can. He deceives and continues in that path until the very end, until there is no hope now for his dead son and the peoples, the firstborn of all their cattle, and every, you know, he's gonna push it to the end. And you know, he's pushing the Lord, and the Lord knew this was going to happen. I mean, you can't blame God for doing things, because you can't blame God for knowing everything that's going to happen. But the Lord knows anyway, and so he's going to give Pharaoh space. He's going to do this, and he's going to display his power in Egypt. Now, did you know that, and I read this somewhere, I don't remember where it was, one of the pharaohs had all historical records of all this, where the Israelites are actually brought out through the plagues and everything, stricken from all their records. That's why in any of the Egyptian artifacts and things that they find, you never find records of this, because they totally wiped it clean. But see, the Lord already has it in the Bible for everybody to read. And that's the way the Lord is. He's not going to, it doesn't matter what the pharaohs do, he's going to intervene, and he's going to bring things down where they're supposed to be. And he does it. Eventually, he has no choice. Pharaoh has no choice. He has to let them go. And now I'm looking at this. It says that there were many different flies that are common in Egypt. And one of the things they think is quite possible is all the dead frogs. Remember, it says that they took them out of the city and they piled them in big heaps. That's a perfect place for the flies to just multiply and multiply and multiply. In dead carcasses, they lay their eggs, and then, you know, they bring more and more flies. they also believed that these could be, and I don't know how they figured this out, but they believed it could be possibly two different types of flies that were in Egypt. One is called a dog fly, and they're almost like, you know how gnats, they fly and they get in your eyes? The dog flies go, I guess, for the moisture, and they get around your eyelids, and then they bite you, and then you get infected in your eyes, and it spreads into your sinuses or whatever. They believe that that's one that causes infection. And then another source believed that they're called stable flies, and these actually were bloodsuckers, where they actually land on you, bite you, and draw blood, which actually you can find around here. You know, you go out to where they have horses, and sometimes you'll be out there, and if you have shorts on, if they're around, they might land on you, and they tag you, and they're like almost like a bee. They just whack you, you know, and then before you know it, you're bleeding there. So they can be, and you get a bunch of those, I mean, you'll be hightailing it pretty quick. The stable flies, they bite humans, and they bite cattle, and when they bite cattle, they can carry anthrax. And the symptom, I believe there's different types of anthrax, but cattle anthrax. And the symptoms of anthrax are pain, headache, fever, nausea, and vomiting. So this particular plague was pretty bad. So it seems as though there's an increase in the severity of the plagues to me. Even though the lice, I mean, that's pretty bad, having lice on your body. Now we're going to flies that bite and can cause infection and cause you to bleed or have welts. I got bit by a fly a while back. I don't know how many years ago it was, maybe 4 or 5 years ago or longer. And I had shorts on. It was in the summer, and it got me. And I had a welt. I had a welt on my calf, a nice size welt just from one bite. So it says here that the Lord was going to make a distinction between the Egyptians and the Israelites. In verse 23, I will put a division between my people and thy people. Tomorrow shall this sign be. So in the Strong's, the word division here means a distinction. He's going to draw a distinction between the Egyptians and between the Israelites. And of course, we know that the Lord is going to deliver them from these judgments, which is really reassuring. Now in 9:4, and the Lord will make a difference between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt. Verse 6, so the Lord did this thing on the next day, and all the livestock of Egypt died, but the livestock of the children of Israel, not one died. Okay, that's actually the next plague, but I just wanted to show you, look in 10:23. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days, but the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. So the word that we're reading, sever, where he severs between them, that means separate or separated. And in chapter 11, he uses the word difference. I'm going to make a difference between both of you. And it's the same Strong's number, it's the same Hebrew word, but there's like 3 or 4 different English words translated that actually mean the same thing, to separate, to mark out, to separate. And then when you look in the theological word study books of the Old Testament, it says the Lord sets apart, and it's the same thing. It's a separation between Egypt and the land of Goshen. And actually, whether you know this or not, the land of Goshen is where a lot of the Israelites lived, which was probably the area of Egypt that was not desirable to live in. They let them live in it. But that was the only place that didn't have the plagues. It's the only place that didn't experience the lice, the frogs, and all that. And now, with this plague, same thing. They don't experience, there's a separation now between the both. And of course, we know and we've heard the scripture in 2 Corinthians where the Lord says, therefore, come out from among them and be separate. Well, what's before the therefore? Therefore, come out from among them and be separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you. I will be a father to you, and I will be Lord. But what's before the therefore? Well, I'm going to tell you when I find it. Sometimes we read a verse, and when you see the word then, you see the word therefore, that means that something has transpired up here before that, and this goes on, this is then this. So when you see the word then, stop and just look above that and see what the then is referring to. So that's how you're supposed to look at things and read. Then I didn't find it. Oh, here it is. Okay, good. Let me read a few verses. Be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness, and what communion has light with darkness? There's a separation. And what accord has Christ with Belial? Or what part has the believer with an unbeliever? And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? There's just a difference between both. The temple of God is the true worship of God. The idols are false gods, and worship goes to the false gods. Now remember, I said this several times, and I illustrated it through the different judgments or the different plagues in the beginning, where the Lord is striking out against the idols of the land. The god of the Nile, the one god, Het, who was the body, has the body of a human, the head of a ram, that's a Nile god. Not N-O-W, N-I-L-E, a Nile god. And so the pronouncements are just not toward Pharaoh. It's not just to bring the children of Israel out of bondage, out of Egypt. The Lord's doing other things too, and he's striking out against the gods. And they're very well aware that their gods cannot overtake and do anything about, even though they worshiped them, even though they had idols, even though they had all their traditions that they went through in their sacrifice and worship of their gods, none of them could deliver them from the hand of God, the Israelites' God, our God. Nothing could deliver them. So he says here, and what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. God has said, I will dwell in them. I will dwell in them. And will walk in them, and they shall be my people. I will be their God. Therefore, because of that, because God is dwelling in them, or what, dwelling in us, and God is walking in us or among us, because of that, therefore, come out from among them and be separate. So in other words, the Lord wants a separation in the heart of believers, in our hearts, in our lives, which we know. Okay, back to Exodus. Exodus 9, 1 through 7.
That of Egypt.
Isn't that nice? Isn't it nice that the Lord didn't do that to his people? Mm-hmm. Even though, and I think this is quite something, even though he knew, like I said, you can't blame God because he knows everything. Even though he knew that they were going to be rebellious, even though he knew that they were not going to really, truly follow him when they got out into the wilderness, still he follows through and he does certain things, and he gives them all the chance, all the opportunity. And even in this, he causes the plagues to be upon the Egyptians, but not upon them. I mean, you talk about a contrast. If I would think if I was standing there and I would look up and I would see all these flies on all these people and all this stuff going on over there, and I'm over here, not that far away, and there's nothing. Which actually, I wonder, why do you think, I'll ask your opinion on this, why do you think that the people, the Egyptians, were suffering these things, why they stayed where they were and didn't go where people were, the Israelites were, that weren't suffering these things?
They were separated.
Exactly. God separated them. And because he separated them for somehow, some way, maybe they didn't see it. Maybe they didn't know it. They were so caught up with what was going on with them, you know, the flies biting them, that they didn't even realize that in Goshen, now Goshen wasn't like you can pick up a stone and throw it there. I mean, it was a little ways away. It was adjacent to, it was part of Egypt, but it was just a part. I think it was the northeast region of Egypt. And like I said, it wasn't a desirable place. That's why they let them there. But that was where the blessing of the Lord is. Now, if you go back into Deuteronomy 28, you know, you read the first, maybe, I guess the first 14 verses of Deuteronomy 28, and the Lord says that if you're obedient, you know, this blessing comes, and this blessing comes, and this blessing comes, and this blessing comes. And then when you get down to around verse 15, it says, if you do not hearken to the word of the Lord, then this curse will come, and this curse will come, and this curse will come. So do you know what the curse, you know what that word means? What does the word curse mean? We read Deuteronomy all the time. We hear it taught all the time, a lot. Does anybody know what that means? Two general meanings. One is very easy. It means the lack of blessing. So if a person's disobedient, it's not like God's calling fire down from heaven, you know, upon them. No. It's that now, from that point on, if they persist in their disobedience, that there will be an absence of blessing in their life. And then another meaning is that the word curse means to bring to a lesser state. So if I start to disobey and I'm persistent in disobedience, that I begin to move into a lesser state as far as my spiritual quality goes. So it doesn't matter how long I've been a Christian. It doesn't matter what I've done in my former years. If I'm now going to be disobedient to the Lord, then I will move into a lesser state, or maybe I guess you could say that you don't progress into certain blessings of God because you're not obedient, because you're moving in this other thing, this other way. And so the people are shielded. Do you know the Lord shields you? If you are a Christian and you are walking with the Lord and you have a desire to do what's right, and you set out to do the right thing in your life, and you want to be with the Lord. You want to, as it says in Acts, they were called Christians. They were called Christians. They follow the Lord. If you are walking with the Lord, He will shield you from certain things. Now, there'll be a time when certain things He will not shield you from. But there's a lot that He shields you from that you do not either experience, or He shields you in a way that certain things just cannot touch you. There was a hedge about Job, right? And what did Satan say? What did he say about Job? He says, I can't get to him because of this hedge. And then the Lord, okay, well, now I'll let you go. But remember, we're not Job. So there's things Job experienced that none of us will experience, I believe. So he makes a difference between the both. And the blessing dwells in one place and the curse in another. And that's the way it is. Not because God intends it to be that way. It's because of the will of man, and men choose whether they will obey and move into blessing, or disobey and move into a lesser state. And God really doesn't have anything to do with that. I mean, He made the pronouncements, but a lot of that is up to the will of the individual. So in one point here, at the very end, and we're getting ahead of ourselves, but that's okay because we're going to stop. One point, whenever God kills the firstborn, and remember, Pharaoh says to Moses, he says, I don't want to see your face any longer. Next time I see you, you're going to die. So he's not really saying, don't stand out at the water like before and wait for me to come out to the water, like the Lord told him. The next time you see me, you'll die. Well, now the firstborn, his son from the throne, dies in his house, and at night he sends for Moses, and Moses comes in. Now, if Pharaoh would have heeded, and I know this is a big if, but if he would have heeded the word of the Lord, I believe that there would have been a blessing in his life. But whenever he sends Moses and Aaron and he says, okay, now take all your people, take all the cattle, take everything and leave, you know what he says? He says, when you go, please bless me. I read that somewhere. Please bless me. Bless me too. It's not that I can pray, and because you want to be blessed by the Lord, and I can pray, and because I pray, you're going to be blessed by the Lord. Well, for you to be blessed by the Lord primarily, and I say primarily, because the Lord, he does a lot of other things. Primarily, it will come through your obedience, my obedience. Because that's what it says in Deuteronomy 28, and that's true. If we obey the Lord, there will be blessing in some way. The Lord might not bless the material realm, but he can still bless you in the inner man, which is the greatest blessing. And he may do both. And a lot of times he does with people. He'll take a person and, you know, he'll enrich them spiritually and materially. And a lot of times I think he does that to see if the Christian is going to be closed fist or open fist. See if they're going to be able to say, you know, not everything is about me. Okay, now I'm going to do something for the Lord. I'm going to let the Lord use me in such and such a way. As I said, the blessing of the Lord will come to an individual if they obey. So Pharaoh didn't want to obey, but he wanted the blessing of God. It doesn't work that way. If he would have obeyed the Lord, even though he was the heathen, I still believe that somehow or other the Lord would have blessed him. But because he persisted in his way and his thinking and his hardness of heart, there was nothing the Lord could do. And let me see if I can find that real quick. But we'll probably cover that next week. Oh, in chapter 12, we'll just read this in closing. And we'll probably go through this again next week. Chapter 12, verse 31. Then he called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, "Rise, go out from among the people, both you and your children of Israel, and go serve the Lord as you have said. Also take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and be gone, and bless me also." Don't forget me. Well, it doesn't matter. First of all, you don't see Moses or Aaron praying for blessing for Pharaoh just because he said it. Because that's not how it's going to come. If he would have been blessed if he would have let them go in the beginning, or there would have been some type of surrender there.